right, we need some volunteers here, and that's nice Liveland from Jefferson Starship. Actually, when I think about that, that wasn't even Starship. That was Paul Kantner, and that was a fairly recent one of Paul Kantner did. Trying to think, that was at the tribute for Chet Helms out in Golden Gate Park, Speedway Meadows, last summer. So, hey, we've got Forrest Hill here. He is one of the candidates for the Secretary of State in California.
That's correct.
Yeah. And now you are the only green candidate on the ballot, so there's no real need for a strong campaign in the June 6th election, right?
Well, I've actually been campaigning since the get-go for the November 7th election.
Okay.
So I've actually already appeared at forums with the two Democratic challengers, Deborah Bowen and Deborah Ortiz. I haven't never met Bruce McPherson, but I have been up in Sacramento dealing with some of the voting machine issues, because that sort of comes under the auspices of the Secretary of State. So I'm very involved, and I've been really kind of running the campaign now for 4 months, and I've been trying to raise money for 4 months, and I actually feel like, we can get our message out probably broader than we've ever done before.
Yeah, now, Secretary of State is kind of an innocuous position. Most people don't realize the importance of it.
Yeah.
Secretary of State handles the elections. It handles honest and fair elections throughout the state. It handles business licenses for various companies. It handles a whole variety of just general, why don't you talk about what you know about the Secretary of State's office?
Sure.
and what we should know about it.
Well, first of all, it's funny to go around and talk about it around the state, because half the people come up to me and think, what, are you running against Condoleezza Rice? they don't even know we have a Secretary of State. But like you said, it's the Chief Elections Officer. And the reason I'm interested in it is I believe that, it's incredibly important, especially for the social movements in this country, that we implement free and fair elections. And right now, by free elections, what I mean is elections that are free from fraud. And obviously we have voting systems that a lot of people feel are very, it's dubious whether we're really having accurate elections. But even if we have totally accurate elections, we need to implement voting systems that allow for greater representation in this country. America really is one of the last bastions where we have a two-party system. And it's because we have a voting system that only allows that type of a system to arise. And that's what's called a winner-take-all voting system. So I'm going around and talking about other ways that we can get more representation in this country, because we have the lowest voter turnout of any developed country in the world. We have the poorest union movement of any country in the world, simply because, for example, the unions don't have their own party. The women's movement is being sold down the street, because the women used to have a strong party, around 1910 during the suffragette movement. They had the National Women's Party, and that really helped them to get the vote. And the same with the abolitionists. They formed their own party, the Liberty Party, and that was really the crux of fighting slavery. And actually, it was became the uprising of the Republican Party, where Lincoln came, the Lincoln version of the Republican Party. So we, in our country, we have a two-party system. Both parties are corporate parties. I believe we need more parties. I'm running not just to, because I believe the Green Party needs to have representation. And I think that we represent a lot of the ideas, but there are a lot of different people that need to have more representation. We need to have voting systems that allow for full representation. And I can...
You mean taxation with representation?
Yes, I know. Well, the funny thing is that, in California, about 30% of the people aren't even registered who are eligible to vote. And another 15% are declined estate or a third party. So if you look at all the eligible voters, only 30% are actually registered Democrat and 25% are registered Republican. But somehow that equates to them having all the power. So I don't know what the other 45% are supposed to do, but they're either supposed to vote for one of those two parties that they don't support, or they just don't vote, or they opt out, which I actually happen to think a lot of them are doing, because they don't really feel like there's any reason to vote. So I think there's a lot of fundamental problems. We could solve a lot of those problems by implementing things like proportional representation for our legislature. So if a party gets 5% of the vote, they can get 5% of the seats. That's the only way you'll ever get a new party to develop, because under our system, unless you win, and in California, you have to win with a lot of money. It's even an assembly district is 450,000 people live in those districts. That's almost impossible for a new party to do. So under proportional system, the nice thing about it, it's almost the opposite of what we have. It allows people with different ideas to slowly build their coalitions around those ideas, and it gives them an arm in government, which is what we do not have now, and it's why I think a lot of people feel so disenfranchised with our political system.
By the way, in California, well, thinking in U.S. history, when the Constitution was originally put together, we were supposed to get a new representative, U.S. congressman, every 60,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the population got bigger, about 1914, the Constitution was rewritten, so to speak, and it forced it so that Congress is now limited to 435 people.
Right.
And so that essentially makes your bribe go further.
That's right. Big districts make, in fact, it's even worse in California. If you look, because I'm running in California, I'm running, you know, concerned a lot with the state legislature, but I really agree with this on Congress. Our state senators, our state Senate districts are even bigger than congressional districts.
Right.
In fact, our state Senate districts and our assembly districts were set in 1879, when they wrote the Constitution, they said there'll be 80 assembly members and 40 senators. And people say, well, that seems reasonable. And I say, well, how many assembly members do you think they have in Vermont? And they said, I don't know. They'll say, I don't know. I say, there's 120 assembly members
sure.
in Vermont. One of our assembly districts is the size of Vermont. So
right.
winning an assembly seat is kind of equivalent to winning the Senate seat in Vermont.
Yeah.
And all it means is, it takes a lot of bucks to do. In fact,
and it will always take even more and more, because in the future so when they limit it, that's what I was leading up to. So we are limited to 80 assemblymen and 40 senators.
And we don't have to be. And actually, I've written a proposal that I've actually shown to quite a few people that would cost about half as much as what's being now proposed for public financing of elections. We could increase the assembly by about five times. It would cost us less money. And the way we would do it is that we would, for one, have the Senate districts is at least no bigger than congressional districts. If we get another, we could get another congressional seat just because of immigration or people moving in from other states, then we get another senator. Within each Senate district, we have five assembly members, and they're elected using what's called choice voting, where you rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in a district-wide race. What that would do is give us a kind of a proportional system or full representation in the assembly, which would make it impossible to gerrymander a district. Because once you have some sort of a proportional system, there is no gerrymandering anymore. There's always the minority view always can get some representation, at least in government. And you could do this for much, much cheaper. We'd have fuller representation. We would start getting more minorities in power. We would start probably having some third parties in power who, once they got elected, then could start working in coalition with some of the major parties, plus also help those social movements in the streets build and not get so fractured.
You mean people would then really get some taxation with representation?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that we would find that more people would begin to participate in our system. And I think, as turned off as we are about government, it's crucial that they do that, because if you look at what's going on really in the last 30 years, really boring things, the things that bore people, tax structure. In the last 30 years, we have moved wealth from, you know, there was this concept of trickle-down theory. What we have is Niagara Falls-up theory. Right now, the top 1% owns basically 50% of the wealth in this country. That's everything from all the stocks and bonds to real estate. 1%, a very small percent, own most of the wealth, and about the top 5% own something like 60-70%. So that's almost medieval distribution of wealth.
That's right.
worse than a lot of third world countries.
That's right.
It's only getting worse. And we've got to start, you know, getting involved, and we especially need to get other parties involved. And one reason I'm running as a third party person for Secretary of State, the rules have been written by the Democrats and the Republicans. And while there seems like there's some liberals who are running in the Democrat who might want to change the rules, they are not going to change the rules to allow other parties to get in, because even if they lose, the Democrats, and this is shown by Gore, in fact, in 2000, they would rather lose than allow another party to come in. They like the system as it is. They will tinker around at the edges. You will hear them saying something about, oh, we're going to do something on redistricting, but they are not about to change the voting system to allow people to have full representation or to allow people to vote for who they really want to without feeling like, if I do, I'm going to elect, you know, someone I really hate. And the best example of that was, of course, what happened in 2004, where we got the anybody but Bush phenomenon. It's like the whole anti-war movement came to a complete halt because they had to vote for a pro-war candidate just because they wanted to get this horrible guy out of office. And you can, everyone can, you know, relate to that. George Bush is awful, what he's doing to the country and the foreign policy he's putting in. But it's a shame that we can't have a pro-peace candidate, which we actually did have in 2004. But those candidates are either not heard, or they're not allowed to be on the ballot, or they're pretty much badgered out of the media. You hear very little bit. And if you were thinking about voting for them, you get a lot of flack because people are saying, well, you're naive. You're helping George Bush get elected. Only in America do we have this kind of system. So we need to change that system. It's not hard. In fact, here in San Francisco, you guys have already done it with instant runoff voting. That kind of gets rid of the whole spoiler effect right there.
Sure. And as a matter of fact, we don't necessarily think about the Secretary of State having influence over local elections, but when we voted in instant runoff voting, it's probably been 4 or 5 years ago by now. It still took over 2 years before it got implemented because the Secretary of State, both under the Democrats and under the Republicans, did their best to challenge it in the courts and complain about printing operations and a variety of different things that were meaningless to it.
Plus, they're dragging their feet now. In fact, you know, in Berkeley, it's the same problem. 2 years ago, they voted to do all the city elections by instant runoff voting. Same with San Lorenzo. So all in Alameda County. Oakland is supposed to do it for their special elections. None of them have pulled it off. In fact, they had a very Brad Clark used to be the registrar over there, who became the Assistant Secretary of State under McPherson. Actually, Brad's left now, who hated instant runoff voting, and he would make statements like, "Well, he went to Australia, and he was shocked to find that instant runoff voting actually allows third parties." And I wrote him a letter and said, "You know, we should warn him. You know, he shouldn't travel too much because most countries you go to have third parties in office.
London.
You know, so it could be bad for his heart. So I said, stay here in America, you know."
even the Olympics uses it, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you have a strong Secretary of State at the state level, those cities where residents have decided that they want to use a ranked choice voting system, they should have the right to do that. You know, they have the right to do that in chartered cities now. I actually believe that all cities, chartered or not, should have that right. But
yeah, for the listeners, why don't you give a quick description of what ranked choice or instant runoff voting is?
Well, you know, the quick and dirty way to think about it is this. You get to choose your candidate you really like the most, and you rank them number one. And then you put your second choice, and you rank them number two. And the idea is this. First of all, whoever wins has to get a majority of the vote, 50% at least of the vote. So you just count the number one votes. And if nobody has 50%, and let's say the candidate you voted for, well, they didn't do very well. They did pretty lousy. You think he's really great, but he did lousy. Well, your vote is switched to your second choice, and they recount the votes again. It's just like having a runoff, like you normally do for mayor here. In the last election, when Matt Gonzalez and Newsom ran, they had, you know, six or seven candidates run. Matt only got 16% of the vote, I believe, or 17% on the first time, and Newsom got 45. Well, the second day, they took a poll, and they were even, like 45 to 45. Why is that? Because the second, third, and fourth choices were all progressive candidates, so they sort of all aggregated their vote to Matt. So what happens is that people tend to, you know, their first choice tends to be very much similar to their second choice. Well, instant runoff vote just lets you do it in one fell swoop. For cities, that's great because you don't have to run two elections, and you tend to get more people participating in the runoff. A lot of times what happens is when you do the runoff election, only 10% of the people showed up for the first race. So this way, more people are voting, you get more voter choice, you get greater diversity in politics, and it allows for, I think, a more diverse electorate.
Sure. One other thing, and people don't really think about it in this way, when you go down to if you've got six candidates running in a primary and you really got somebody you truly believe in, but you don't think that they're going to win, you still can put them number one.
Right.
And then, you know, you can hold your nose and put whoever the front runner is as number two. When, after the election is over, your number one choice will have a greater chance of truly knowing how many people believe in their positions. And so even though they officially lose on election day, for the rest of the next number of years, it'll be recognized that they have that many people that truly believe in them. And so their positions, when they continue to lobby on other issues throughout the next couple of years, they will have the recognition that, hey, this person truly can draw 16-20% of the population. Mm-hmm. And even though they don't win the election, they truly have the ear of the voter. And so it gives better lobbying right. power even in the off years.
I will say this. Actually, I think as people get used to it, you might find that a lot of those people start to win. And the reason is, if you do polls in America, something like two-thirds of Americans would say they would vote for a third party if they thought it could win. Well, once they get used to the system and realize that they no longer are trapped into voting for the lesser of two evils, you will find people thinking, you know what? I maybe am really going to vote for who I believe in on my first vote and put this, you know, the sort of lesser of two evils for my second vote. That will really open it up. But I think, too, we need to differentiate between what I call single-seat races, like the executive branch. You know, in America, we have executive and legislature. In a lot of countries, they have parliament. So for executive seats like governor, secretary of state, treasurer, president, I think instant runoff voting would be terrific. It would really open up, you know, who we get to vote for. But for our legislature, which is sort of the body that represents the people, there we would be much better off going to a proportional voting system. There's many ways to enact it, but 106 nations right now use proportional voting. Every European nation uses it. When South Africa, when the AMC won, sort of had a victory, and they basically won the election, they could have implemented a winner-take-all system like we have here in America, and basically Africans would have won all the seats. There had been no whites in that government. But they thought it was important to have input from everybody, even their oppressors. And so they put a proportional voting system in. And I think, you know, because what you find is then when those people come in, they have a viewpoint, people work in coalition, and a lot of times you tend to get a lot more done than under a two-party system. Because you have to convince people to join with you in coalition, and that's very different than trying to go out and say the Democrats are really awful because they want to raise taxes, and then Republicans, you know, or the Democrats turn around and say, oh, the Republicans are really awful because they want to, you know, get rid of abortion. It becomes a negative way of running government, and I think proportional representation leads to a more coalition and positive building way of running government.
So in other words, lies and innuendo don't work as often when you actually have a proportional representation.
Right.
And lies and innuendo then create civil strife and,
yeah.
and the nation. It's actually very expensive when you've got a nation running with lies and innuendo, because it takes a huge amount of time for the government to get established, because it has to constantly fight this negative propaganda. And so the voters, the taxpayers, are constantly at a loss because they're never in a position where they can have a comfortable government.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when it comes down to it, we need to create a democracy here. We need to get corporate money out of politics. We need to have smaller districts because we can have more grassroots campaigning that will really represent the people. Because really, democracy is sort of where the rubber meets the road. You know, if you have issues on the war, you feel like we need, now you're not just anti-war, but you feel like we need a new foreign policy, a new sane foreign policy. Maybe we need parties that will push that. If you really believe that we need strong unions that are democratic, maybe those people who believe in those ideas should have a party. I mean, it's amazing we don't have a labor party in America. I mean, hardly any country does not have a labor party. If you are for women's rights, I mean, if you look what's going on with women's rights right now, it's abysmal. I mean, compared to where women were 20 years ago, abortion is practically illegal now. It's certainly illegal if you're poor. I mean, they may say that it's still around. And it's only, you know, probably about 10% of the counties in America can you get an abortion. So these issues are tied tightly to how we vote. And until we get a voting system that will allow greater diversity in politics, we're always going to be fighting these battles in the street. And that's really important, to keep the fights up in our community, because that's how change has always happened. But when you don't have a party, also like a political arm, I think you're always fighting with one arm tied behind your back, because as soon as you let down the fight, they're, you know, they pull you into the fold and they begin to ignore your issues. So I think that, you know, that's why I'm running. I think these are really important issues. I think they're really important for the immigrant rights movement. I think they're really important for God, my phone's ringing. What do you know? I think, you know, for universal health care, most countries that have proportional representation have universal health care. I think it's really important for education right now. the spending that we're spending right now in our tax structure is so structured for the wealthy, you know, that it's really making it impossible to fund those social programs that are really needed. And it's through election reform, and I think we can begin to take this country back.
Well, that's, again, back to taxation with representation.
Right.
Essentially, lies and innuendo. They've turned the elections into some sort of a sporting event. And so rather than looking at the true issues, and rather than, you know, when we were kids and playing in childish games, they said it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. That, in terms of politics, is out the door. And it's the taxpayer, the TV viewer, the spectator of politics is always looking at it as if it's some sort of a game, a contest,
right.
And they don't look at it truly as whether or not they are, as taxpayers, going to get something for their taxes. And it's very interesting. In 1776, of course, the big issue was united you stand, divided you fall.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, these neocons are essentially pushing. It's the proud loner that makes it, and that if you band together, you're some sort of a communist. So what they're saying is, divided you stand, united you fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so the propaganda is the proud loner, the Rocky, some sort of a proud loner is the one that should make it, and that if you band together, that there's some sort of an evil to that.
Well, I do think that there is a banding together going on in America. I mean, if I look at the immigrants' rights movement, that to me is an organic movement, and it's just grown out of, you know, it's like a sleeping giant has come to wake. And the thing about the immigrants' rights movement is people think, well, it's just about undocumented workers. It's about much more than that. You know, first of all, a lot of immigrants in this country are not just from South America and Mexico. They're, you know, from the Philippines or from South Asia. Huge populations. But
Ireland.
It's also a working rights movement. And that is what's growing on, because in this country, most people have not had, the bottom 90% have not really had a wage increase over the last 30 years when you adjust their wage for inflation. And so people are starting to fall behind. What's helped people out a lot, of course, is equity in their homes and that two people now work. So that sort of helped people buy more stuff and get ahead. But now it's becoming harder and harder. So I do think that there are some banding together and movements that are actually starting to explode. I also think this is good. I'm very optimistic, I should tell you this. I think that we progressives, or if you consider yourself on the left or whatever, we need to start saying we have a vision and we can change this country. And I think the way we can change this country is we got to start winning elections on the local level like you're doing here in San Francisco, because that's what the religious right started doing in 1972. It's not something that you're going to win in 2 years, or 4 years. We've got a long ways to go, but the fight and the struggle to do that is very important. I think we need to keep our eye on the prize. A lot of people are really upset about our election system, and they're really upset about the direction of this country. And it's not just Greens. I should not talk about my father. He's a Republican, and my father will call me up the other, like a couple weeks ago, and he's 80. I get along with him very well, but he watches Fox and CBS. That's where he gets his news. And he believes that we should withdraw the troops now. This is my dad, who's been a staunch Republican for years. So I think that there's a lot of dissatisfaction with this country from a whole spectrum of people, and we have to start saying, okay, we have the satisfaction. What is the vision that we want to see, and where do we want to go? Because the thing about America, I think there's a lot of really bright people in America. But for some reason, we keep electing the fools to office, and there's got to be a reason for that. And a lot of it has to do with our election system. A lot of it has to do is that a lot of these people are just sort of front people for corporations. You know, that is not helping America at all. And we need to create a system that gets corporate money out of elections and starts getting a greater participation by the masses in power. Because for democracy, for all its faults, you know, I still think it's the best system going. The thing is, we don't really have a democracy here. And we need to start implementing that democracy here, because we need to start getting people active in our government. Otherwise, we're going to find that our country is totally taken away from us. And we'll be facing the consequences of that.
Well, that's right. And when you look at it in a structural way, I think you mentioned that, 30% are Democrats currently in California, 25% Republicans.
Of all eligible voters. Yeah.
Right, and the rest are independents. And
or not registered.
Yeah, yeah. And so as you were describing, the need to get educated people involved in the government, typically the educated are those independents.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the voting system is set up, if you show up at a primary, if you're an independent, you don't have the right to make a decision on who the Republicans choose or the Democrats. You only have the right to choose your particular party. And if you put yourself down as an independent, then you can't necessarily grab a ballot of either side. And so you can't.
I think actually independents can vote in the Democrat or Republican primary. You can pick. Actually, in the Green primary.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Decline to state. Can.
Yeah.
But if you're of another party, you can't.
That's correct.
Yeah, and so since most people make the mistake of signing up as American independent.
Well, that's a small group of people. Yeah, that was a.
But that old George Wallace party. But in other words, this idea that the smart people are not allowed to come to the fore,
mm-hmm.
because it's so much turned into a sporting event.
Right.
And that lies and innuendo and big money are the technique of choice, for keeping the ignorant in power. It's this madness that is forcing the democracy to play to the sporting event,
yeah.
as opposed to playing to the genuine needs of the population.
Yeah. I it's not that I think every politician, by the way, I think lies. I actually think there's some genuine people who, really believe in what they're saying. I'm not saying, and that's probably true for Republicans and Democrats. I think what we find is that we just have pretty banal discussion on the issues, simply because the two-party system really demands it. There's no reason to go into long explanations or try to get into the complexities of the issue, because all you want to do is separate yourself slightly from your opponent. So if you're a Republican, you want to just appear just a little bit to the right, and that means you get everybody who's to the right of you, that sort of whole field is all yours. And if you're the Democrat, you want to pick one or two issues where you're just slightly to the left of the Republican, then you have this the whole other side of the spectrum. So we don't really have much conversation. It just, whether it's lies or not, I mean, it's more to me is that we're not even talking about the issues. We don't really talk about foreign policy. We don't talk about what we're doing in the world. I think that you would find that people become much more educated in those issues if we had more choices. In Europe, when they do an election, they run it in 3 or 4 weeks because everyone knows what all the parties stand for. They know their platforms. And, you might vote for the Green one time, and maybe next time you vote for the Social Democrat because you find you like their leadership better. But probably if you're on the left, you wouldn't vote for the Christian Democrats, but you may have some movement within those left parties, and they do it fairly quickly. And what you find in a lot of those countries is that they tend to have everyone at least has some say in government. They certainly have much better health care over there than we do. And I think a lot of it has come out of that kind of system. They also can't spend a ton of money. I mean, Tony Blair can only spend £10,000 when he runs for office. I mean, that's like $18,000, something like that. How much do you spend to run for supervisor? You spend a lot more than that. And this guy's running for an office where, that's for his MP seat, but still he's sort of a world leader.
Wouldn't even do a single mailing to everybody in the state.
They have free TV access for all qualified candidates. Yeah. I mean, if you meet some sort of qualification where you can show broad support, why not have people on who have different ideas? I'm not saying you put everybody on, but if you can show that, you've got broad support, like, for example, with public financing, they're talking about if you can raise, let's say, $500 contributions or $1,500 contributions, depending on the seat, that suggests that a lot of people really want to get behind you. So if you can show some sort of support, let's hear from a broader range of candidates instead of just hearing a Wesley and Angelides commercial back and forth that blames each other for negative advertising or something like that.
Yeah, you wonder if, the Republicans haven't made their way into the... I don't know if you've heard of this K Street project, but Jack Abramoff set it up so that the publicity people in Washington, D.C., the PR firms, were all staffed by Republicans.
Right.
If you were going to do any publicity work for the U.S. government, you had to be a Republican.
Uh-huh.
So now you've got Wesley and Angelides are essentially tearing each other to pieces. And they're going to have no reputation. Whoever wins in June is going to have a turd of a reputation. And you wonder if this K Street project worked its way into California, where the PR folk are nothing but Republicans trying to make the Democrats look massively
well,
ugly.
I think the Democrats are going out of their way to look as much like the Republican Party as they can.
Well,
I think that's been going on for a long time. You know, they decided to sort of, I think Jesse Jackson was really their last candidate that really went out and tried to register people to vote under the Rainbow Coalition,
sure, yeah.
Where he was out in inner cities trying to register disenfranchised minorities, more working people. The Democrats have given up on that. You know, they also run, you know, under the Democratic Leadership Council, do a lot of focus groups, try to figure out, you know, where their support is. I mean, when you get up to president, it's all about a couple states anyway,
right.
Because all the rest of the states are, you know, already determined. And the way our electoral college system is since the Republican states happen to be all the small states, the Republicans are actually always going to be favored in the elections. It's just because there's this weird abnormality about the electoral college that includes the senators and the congresspeople. And in the small states get two senators just like California does. So
small state advantage, right?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, so we definitely do need to keep people educated nationwide as well as statewide. So tell us about your background. What led you to choose to run for Secretary of State?
Well, I've had kind of I've been involved in politics for a long time. I was a union member in the 70s. I worked for Conrail. So I was in the United Transportation Union for a couple of years. And then I just sort of took some time off, did a little traveling, mostly hitchhiking, as all young people, I guess, did it back then. And then I became a carpenter and a house painter, and I was a musician through the 80s. And then I got very involved, though, in the Nicaragua issue, so in the whole Central America issue. In the 80s, Reagan and the Reagan administration at all were funding a war against the Nicaragua people through what are called the Contras, who we train. There was also a war going on in El Salvador. Again, we were funding it through proxy armies. I actually went down to Nicaragua a couple times, and it was pretty overwhelming to go down there because most of the people in that country, very poor country, probably the average age of the country was probably 15. I mean, it's like a country of kids. And they were fighting off a fairly ferocious army. And we could roam anywhere. And the first time I learned something about the press was when I would see Stephen Kinzer from the New York Times. He would give these little talks. He was the New York Times correspondent at the Hotel Intercontinental, which was the one nice hotel in Managua, which was kind of like a Holiday Inn that had been bombed out. But he would never leave there, but he would say, oh, how they're communist and how you can't leave the country. And he would be talking to these people from all over the world. You have Europeans there. You'd have Canadians there. And he would be telling them, you know, the Nicaraguans would not let us leave the hotel. And we would be just laughing because all of us were traveling all over the country. No one ever asked us for a passport. I mean, occasionally you'd get stopped and say, well, you might not want to go over there because there's a battle going over there right now. But other than that, it was a wide open country. And so I became very enamored with those people, but also I really became astute to the fact that our media does not tell us the truth. Or gives us a very limited opinion, and we need to realize that in this country. Then I actually didn't go to school until I was actually 33. I went back to UMass Boston, and then I just kept going, and ended up with a PhD from MIT in marine biology. So I sort of took 10 years off from politics and did a lot of science and got very involved in the environment. And I came out here to UC Davis and taught a couple years as an ecologist and did some work for the California Fish and Game on salmon restoration. And then I got back involved in the Green Party, of course, when Nader ran in 2000. I got very involved in that race. And I've run a lot of campaigns for the Green Party, a lot of local races. I've helped out on a race quite a bit in Oakland for a woman named Amy Allison, who's running for city council as a Green.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just thought I would like to do this. Matt Gonzalez called me up and said you should do it, so here I am, I'm running, and I'll tell you, I'm not looking at it as like, well, it's just a token race, because I've had so much campaign experience. I really believe in this, you know, we need change. I do know that what we're trying to do may be a 10 or 15 year project, But I feel like it's my job to push the envelope a little bit farther, you know, and so the next person can come up behind me and push it even farther, get more young people involved, because we've got to make these fundamental changes in this country. So those are the kinds of things that are driving me. I believe we can be a good country, but I believe we're losing it right now to a very small minority who is really leading this country in the wrong direction.
Sure. Politics of despair and chaos, essentially. Yeah.
Well, we need politics of hope, especially on the progressives and left. I mean, most of the left I know are so, oh, there's nothing we can do. We've got to stop thinking that way. We've got to stop saying we've got to get these bad people out of office.
Yeah.
We got to go beyond impeach Bush. We got to say, yeah, let's impeach Bush, but we need to do X, Y, and Z. We need to have a sane, you know, alternative energy program. We need to have universal health care. We need to have a sane program to deal with immigration in this country that treats people fairly like human beings and is in line with the UN Charter. So,
sure.
I mean, those are all things that we all believe in. Let's start putting them in action, because there's a lot of smart people on the left. We need to start working together.
And if you want your kids to respect you, you better have something better than nihilism.
Plus, if you want your kids to have a world, we better do something, because we're going to end up using up all the resources very quickly, especially with the kind of economic system we have in place. So.
Yeah, now that's actually one other aspect of the Secretary of State's office, the business licenses.
Right.
And the Secretary of State essentially can control who does business in California. And obviously, Enron should not have been allowed to do business in California. Any number of these major corporations have been looting and polluting and cheating and stealing pensions and a whole variety of different things. Do you want to take any position on...
I kind of think of it as a two-prong approach. You know, right now I'm a financial advisor. I've sort of moved from science to that, and I do it in social responsible investing. I believe that we need to come up with ways to reward companies that are doing the right thing. Those companies that don't pollute. Those companies that treat their employees well. Those companies that don't have CEO compensation that is just out of this world. On the other hand, I think we need corporate charter reform. When a corporation gets their charter here, there should be some sort of review process, maybe every 5 years or something. If a company is continually breaking environmental laws, are they helping out our state? I think that we need to bring people together. I can't say I have the solutions on this. I mean, one of the ideas that have been proposed is a three strikes law for corporations. If they have three major environmental violations against them, well, they lose the right to practice being a corporation in California. But I think we can bring the small business community together on this. I don't think it's just we have to, like, say all corporations are bad. I think that we need to come up with incentives to make corporations do the right thing. I mean, corporations do employ a lot of people. Companies, or especially a lot of small companies, come up with a lot of innovation. We should be promoting that innovation, especially innovation in alternative energy. But at the same time, we need to hold them, those corporations, responsible that are taking advantage of our state. And Enron and a lot of the independent energy producers is a perfect example, because the reason we still have this massive budget crisis is because of the deals that that Davis signed with the independent energy producers when they were charging outrageous prices. And we're now, of course, in the price of natural gas came way down, and we're still really paying for those problems. So those are really fundamental problems, and I think we have to challenge us. But again, even at that level, we also need to have legislatures that are astute. For example, every single senator and assembly person, let me tell you, that was in office in 1996, and maybe you should look and see if any of them are running now, every single one of them voted for deregulation of the energy markets, and they knew that the so-called alternative green energy would never be able to compete with the Enrons and the Calpines and all these people, because they were getting a very small share of the market. And if you know anything about economics, fairly quickly those producers were eliminated from the scene. So the fact is that you don't have anybody in the legislature who's saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we don't want to deregulate energy. Maybe energy is too important to say, let's just throw it to the free market and we'll have, you know, everything will work out fine. I mean, I think that at least there's some people in this state who don't believe that way. So I know that's kind of getting away from your question. I do believe we need to have corporate oversight. The other thing that the Secretary of State does is domestic partnership. It's through the Secretary of State's Office of Domestic Partners. Gay and lesbian can register for domestic partnership. And we actually have a pretty good domestic partnership law here. It's almost like, it's basically a civil union. It's not gay marriage, obviously, because you don't have any of the federal rights. But as Secretary of State, I think that's also a very important issue. And I believe the domestic partnership laws are going to come under attack. There was an initiative they're trying to get on the ballot for November. I don't know if they'll succeed. Focus on the Family and some of them to not only say, you know, gay marriage should always be illegal in California, but that the state should never be able to give people, same-sex couples, the same rights as married couples, which is really an attack against domestic partnership rights. So as Secretary of State, the other thing I would be is very vigilant speaking out against that, because we really need to have gay marriage in this state. But until we get gay marriage, we need to stand and protect those domestic partnership laws that we have on the books.
Well, again, it's taxation with representation. All of these variety of different people they are all taxpayers, whether they're immigrants, whether they're labor, whether they're gays, whether they're, neocons. Everybody is a taxpayer, and they all have the same claim to be able to convince their politicians that their money should be spent toward their beliefs. And they all have the same lobbying power. Unfortunately, big money has the wild card and convinces us that some people are expendable and that they don't have the right to taxation with representation.
Right.
So, yeah, that's the importance of the Secretary of State's role. So.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a fun race. Again, I hope that people get involved in this race.
You're a given, though, in June 6th, and you're automatically on the ballot in November.
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely, if you want volunteers and if you want to have people invite you down to their county somewhere in California, how should they get in touch with you?
Well, one way they can do that is go to my website, because there's a volunteer page there, and the website is www.voteforest.org, so forest is spelled F-O-R-R-E-S-T, so voteforest.org, and you can volunteer right on the web page. You can also send me an email send the email to forest@voteforest.org if you're interested in volunteering. We have all kinds of areas we're looking for people. We have event coordinators we're working with now. I've got phone bankers out working. They're working tonight. So there's all kinds of things. We need people at the table. We are really going to run a grassroots campaign, but we're also working on using a lot of alternative media, the internet, probably some TV ads even in October. We're really trying to raise money for that. And we've actually raised quite a bit of money, I think, for a third-party race. So I'm confident that at least a big sector of the state is going to hear about a race and know that there's a different voice out there than just the Democrats and Republicans.
Well, thinking in terms of who should contribute to you, frankly, I would think that businesses are being crushed by the major corporations. Many of the small and medium-sized businesses are having a huge time trying to compete against the unfair advantage that these major corporations have got.
Right.
And if the Democrats and Republicans are not going to support small business, it's definitely to their advantage to look for some, you know, a third alternative for Secretary of State in California this year.
Yeah, I think so. I think I think a lot of people can contribute. And I think that you're not just contributing to my campaign, you're contributing to change in California. So I've been talking to everybody. I've been on all kinds of, from conservative talk radio to, you know, KPFA. So I believe that we need to talk to everybody. I've met a lot of Republicans who are, you know, saying, you know what, we do need to open up the election system. So this isn't really just a message about the Green Party. It's a message about let's create a democracy and full representation in this country. And as a Green, I support those values. Well, if we have full representation, then it's up to us as a party to convince other people that what we are saying is right, you know.
All right. Hey, well, thank you, Forrest. Again, look for him on the ballot in November. And by all means, get out there and register and make sure you get your friends registered to vote for the good cross-section of candidates this year. This is a really dangerous time, and we need to, if I understand right, the current Secretary of State is a Republican who was brought in to replace the Democrat who was tossed out in a scandal. Mm-hmm. That's right. Kevin Shelley was tossed out in a scandal. It may have even been a completely fraudulent scandal, but if I remember right, the current Secretary of State comes from a publishing family down in Santa Cruz, and he portrays himself as a moderate, but he does tend to support, in fact, if I understand right, the Diebold voting machines are still being allowed to do business in California, and they are going to control a great many votes in California this year. And if you want to make sure that Diebold voting machines are no longer used in California, you'll see to it that that the current Secretary of State is McPherson is tossed out on his ear. He's known every bit of the time that he's been in office that these machines are not viable, that they're dangerous, that they are subject to hacking, and your ability to vote may be it may be jeopardized this year anyway, but in the future it's going to be worse than ever. So we've got to get rid of these ugly machines and move on to a future we can all believe in.
Right. I should say just really quickly on the voting machine, and people are obviously very interested in this. I'm the only one who's saying that we need to vote on paper ballots. We need to use paper ballots to market. We can count them, I believe, with machines that can count paper ballots, but those ballots have to stay with the machines. Use an optical scanner system here in California. The nice thing about them, the programs are easy to write. We could have open source code that would you could teach, you know, you can have a college kid write the code for, and they're perfect for choice voting. There's a lot of what are called ballot templates out there that are really great for helping the disabled to vote. So there's no need to go to touchscreen voting to supposedly help disabled voters. In fact, a lot of times the touchscreen voting machines are just very difficult for the disabled to use. But more importantly, I also believe that we need to have one system in the whole state of California. Right now it's ridiculous. Every single county has a different voting system. Again, nowhere in the world do you have this sort of patchwork system of voting. And the problem with that is that a lot of times you get into poor areas or urban areas, they have a very inferior voting system to areas where there's money. And really, to me, that violates the Voting Rights Act. We should have a single uniform system. I think the Secretary of State should work with registrars throughout the state to make sure our system is uniform, that we only use paper ballots as the record of your vote. We can count them on some sort of optical scan machine. I can actually work with that. I think that can work. But it's the paper ballot that's your vote. And we need to make sure as best we can that we reduce fraud at all levels. So.
Yeah, that's right. We've gotten into one dangerous situation with these voting machines. The ability for them to control the vote, like you were mentioning, the poorer counties, many of the poorer counties have been convinced that if they buy the machines of the wealthy, that those even though they're used, they may be 10 or 15 years old, that they're in some way superior. And as was learned in Florida and many of the other states, these are not only dangerous machines, many of them are broken.
Yeah, well, and, I think no one's going to go to the, you know, the punch card anymore after Florida. I think, if you look at through American history, at least in the last 20 years, really the voter marked ballots are the most reliable. There's no system, by the way, that's fraud proof. I can tell you that right now. Even if you did it all on ballots and you counted by hand, I mean, one only has to go back to Chicago, or San Francisco, where you find, ballot boxes in the bay, to realize that all elections can be manipulated. We need to come up with systems that really reduce that. The problem with touchscreen voting is that the opportunity for fraud is large scale, and that's something that's quite new because you're sending information to a centralized system and your vote is actually stored in electronic form. So you never really see it. Now, they may have a voter verified paper trail, as they like to say, that, prints out, but that doesn't really guarantee that that there's not tampering going on. And even if there's not tampering going on, it's really imperative that the people who vote believe there's not tampering going on. Because if people begin to doubt that there's, you know, the elections are legitimate, then you're going to, again, reduce voter turnout. You're going to have fewer people even believing in the system. And I think eventually, I mean, cynicism is just going to set in to such a high degree that I think it's going to hurt our system.
Well, it's also profiteering. If I understand right, Diebold has got it set up so that they have a patent on their machine, they've got a patent on their software, and that they actually consider your vote as a copyright. And so that if you vote in order to get a recall, you have to pay them royalties for being able to see your vote because they own your vote. It's not that they're an agency and they're doing a service for the state or the county. They actually own your vote, and that they can charge us for that vote, for the, right, the review of it, and that further we have, because it's a trademark infringement or a copyright infringement, we don't have the right to see the software because it's a trade secret. And so we, the taxpayers, are paying them outrageous amounts of money for the management of our vote, and then we never truly know whether it's secret or not.
Yeah, you know,
or truly,
I never know.
Honest,
you know, yeah, I never know the answer to those questions. Off, to be honest with you, my feeling is that we can have voter free from fraud elections, and that just takes really oversight. I mean, there are a lot of the whole idea of paper ballots is pretty much starting to catch on. A lot of election officials now wish they hadn't bought some of the touchscreen machines, and you even find that in Alameda this time where they're going to run on paper ballots only. And they have Diebold there. So I think that, you know, there's been a lot of great pressure. There's a lot of good registrars, especially the elected registrars, who are tending to shy away from those machines now. And, I mean, I'm a little bit more worried that in the middle of the country, you know, they've just sort of gone hog wild for these sorts of voting machines. I think that regardless if people have fraudulent intent or not, we have to make sure that the systems are in place, that there's oversight by election officials, that there's oversight by citizens, and that we have a single system that works for everybody in the state, because counting the vote is not rocket science. Counting the vote is the easy part. What the hard part is then creating a system where the vote really matters, okay? And that I really think is where the work is really needs to be done.
Hey, we thank you. So we've been discussing the upcoming Secretary of State's race in California coming up in November, and we've been talking with the Green candidate for Secretary of State, Forrest Hill. And if you'd like more information on their race, go to www.voteforrest.org and VOTEFORREST.org. All right. Thanks again, Forrest.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me.
All right. My pleasure.